Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Development in Canada's forests introduces many issues that affect biodiversity. Scientists are looking for ways to mitigate these changes. For the last 5 years, biologist Dave Latham has been tracking wolves and deer in northeastern Alberta. They're on the increase, while woodland caribou are on the decline. And with help from a computer simulation model called Patchworks, Louisiana Pacific is developing sustainable forest management practices for its operations. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. This past winter, on a trip north, I passed four wolves standing beside the highway just south of Athabasca. It was an unusual sighting, but one that might become more common in the near future. Dave Latham is a PhD candidate involved with the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta. And for the past 5 years, Dave has been tracking wolves in northeastern Alberta. This is part of his research on wolf populations and what impact these might have on woodland caribou. Predator-prey relationships seem to be changing quite quickly as wolves and white-tailed deer move into what was traditionally caribou habitat, the peatlands. Dave talked about his findings at a recent workshop on integrated landscape management.
Our understanding of this caribou range I was doing this in was that wolves were pretty much absent from this large expanse of fen bog area that the caribou used. So we were just interested to see, based on some anecdotal information we had, that wolves were starting to increase their use of this area to see if they were indeed out there. Predator inventory for wolves proved to be pretty useful in the fact that we worked out what bits of the landscape wolves were using, and so it's sort of given us the drive to then go on and look at things in a little bit more depth.
So you found then that there actually were substantial numbers of wolves moving into the area?
Well, we don't know about numbers of wolves, but we certainly had plenty of wolf activity out in areas where, based on past research, we believe they shouldn't have been. And these areas were in very close proximity to caribou, so they were definitely out there.
What's the significance then of that?
Well, the belief is, based on some of this past research, that caribou occupy these large peatland areas where there are no moose or very few moose and other primary prey species, and so wolves tend not to frequent these areas. So in other words, they're spatially separated from these other players in the system and likely have a lower risk of predation because of it. If you have increased use of an area by wolves, then just by chance, perhaps, you're going to have more encounters between caribou and wolves and caribou being killed.
What has been the next step?
Well, there's been a number of steps. Firstly, we've been monitoring and surveying for moose and deer distribution and relative abundances. And we've been doing this via aerial surveys in the winter. We've completed five aerial surveys to date. And we've also looked at this in the snow-free months using pellet transects to try and get some sort of an idea whereabouts moose and deer are distributed during the caribou calving season. With regard to the wolves, what we've done is we've gone on and we've deployed VHF and GPS radio collars on the animals to try and work out what bits of the range they're really using. To date, we've had 32 wolves from 12 packs radio collared.
What then is the interplay between all of these different animals?
Well, it's pretty complex. There are a number of different hypotheses as to how things could be working, but with regard to the primary prey, our belief is that if you have increases in the numbers of moose and deer in a system, that this may be able to increase the number of wolves. So in other words, you're going to have a numeric response to an increased amount of food on the landscape. And with more wolves over the landscape, you're going to have more hunting units out in the caribou range. And so by chance, you're likely to have more caribou-wolf encounters and thus more caribou being killed.
What did these aerial surveys show you? What did you find?
Well, with regard to the moose, which have always been the traditional primary prey species for wolves in this area, we didn't find a great deal. However, the big driver or new species that we see in this system is white-tailed deer. They just appear to have gone through the roof. And this comes out both in aerial surveys and in the pellet transects we've been doing. Now, based on kill site investigations and wolf diet analysis, it appears that white-tailed deer are particularly important in the system during winter. We're not sure why this is, but it might be that deer are less able to escape in deep snow conditions. And so they may be an important factor for wolves, particularly in the winter. And so you may have decreased wolf mortality over the winter months.
Now, the presentation that you gave this morning focused on white-tailed deer as being an invasive species in northeastern Alberta. So what's happening there?
Well, we're not really sure. There have always been deer in northeastern Alberta. However, they tend to have been confined in relatively low numbers to the well-drained upland habitat. At the moment, we're seeing them move out into this area that we've traditionally thought of as caribou range. There are a number of different mechanisms for why they may be moving out there, and these are currently starting to be investigated. At the moment, all we've really managed to do is document that they are out there, and the rest is sort of speculation. Is it climate? Is it agriculture further to the south? Or is it perhaps some sort of footprint from industry such as cut blocks?
So are you saying then, instead of finding them just in behind the trees in the forest, that they're actually out there in the middle of the peat bogs?
In winter we found good numbers out in the peat bog. Even in summer you'll find quite a few out there. But we're not sure whether it's the distribution of deer that's important or just the fact that we've got an increase in prey over this landscape and you have seasonal differences in the importance of various prey species, and wolves are using different parts of their range seasonally as well and concentrating on different prey species accordingly. So, as I say, it might be just that white-tailed deer are particularly important during a time that maybe pups have struggled to get enough food to survive. And so white-tailed deer might be filling that sort of gap, traditional gap.
Well, what would entice them to move? What would they be eating? When you drive down Highway 2, from Edmonton to Calgary, you see deer everywhere out in the farmers' fields eating grain. What are they eating up north in peat bogs?
Well, I mean, there's a great question. We're not really sure what they're eating out in the bog. This last survey that I did, we had very deep snow conditions, and a number of the locals up there, outfitters, trappers, etc., have suggested that maybe tree lichens are very important for white-tailed deer during these lean months. We're not sure about that, so that's another thing that we're going to have to really focus in on.
Do you have any indication what the actual increase is in terms of their numbers or their proportion on the landscape?
Well, we do have historic information from this range. It was done in the mid-1990s by a guy called Adam James, and he surveyed the range in the exact way that we have. So we've, in other words, replicated his design. And he had very few deer sightings during the time he did it. In fact, I believe it was about 12 deer seen over two surveys, and they were confined exclusively to upland habitat. Since we've been doing it, we've been seeing anywhere from 50 to 150 deer a survey. So it's increased substantially.
Since the wolves are going after the white-tailed deer and the deer are going out into the bogs, has that changed what the wolves do in any way?
Well, the biggest thing we're seeing with the wolves is that they're utilizing this range that has been exclusive to caribou in the past. But we're not sure that it's white-tailed deer that are necessarily driving this use of the bog habitat. The time that we're seeing the greatest proportion of wolf use of this caribou range is during the snow-free months. So there's some very interesting things going on there that we haven't really worked out yet. But during the snow-free months, beaver are very, very, very high in wolf diet. It appears as though beaver numbers are highest in the Fen Bog area. And so it might simply be that the wolves are going out after the beaver and encountering the caribou on their way out. So, as I say, that the white-tailed deer might may be playing a different role, and that could be with causing a numeric response by the predators by providing a good food source during winter.
So getting back to the deer then, is there any indication at this time as to why the white-tailed deer are moving further north or moving into these areas where traditionally they haven't been?
You know, that's a good question. There are a number of possibilities. One is climate. A lot of people suggest that it is simply the warmer winters that we're having, less snow on the ground. But then it's quite likely that it could just be the increased amount of forage available on features such as cut blocks that are providing more food for them to allow them to expand further north. In the area that I'm working in, it's a comparatively small area to answer a question like that. So you need to answer this question at a much larger scale to try and isolate these different factors. And so, as I say, we're trying to get at that with a different project currently.
So you have an indication now that these things are happening on the landscape. What are your next steps to figure out why these things are happening?
Well, as I say, the deer is... white-tailed deer problem is currently being investigated by another researcher. So hopefully we'll be able to pull her work in to try and work out what effect this might be having for the caribou in Alberta. My next steps are to try and work out if we have indeed had an increase in the number of wolves in the area and how this may affect the caribou. And also to try and work out what role features such as seismic lines are having for wolf movements and where we are finding wolf kills, whether they're closer or further to further from these features than we'd expect. So that's where I'm sort of headed next. But at the moment we've just completed phase one, which is really shoring up this idea of change that there has been an increased risk of predation for caribou since the mid-1990s.
What does that mean then for the caribou?
Well, the caribou in my particular range have been declining quite dramatically for the past 3 or 4 years. They were relatively stable throughout the late 90s to about 2001, and since then the population has been declining. And this is definitely in line with recent results where we have found that the proportion of caribou and wolf diet has increased substantially.
What then are the implications for caribou and caribou management based on what you've found so far?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is that we found that these white-tailed deer have increased prolifically in the system. And a large number of those deer are confined to areas around the periphery of the range, and yet the wolf pack territories themselves overlap both the adjacent upland habitat where you've got high numbers of deer and the caribou. So one of the large unknowns in our system is if you've got these prey species that are in very high numbers around the periphery of the caribou range and appear to be very important in wolf diet and potentially increasing wolf numbers, what scale do we actually need to manage the landscape at for caribou? How far out from the caribou range do we need to go? Do we need to manage the deer in the adjacent upland habitats, or is it just within the caribou range itself? So these are pretty big unknowns, and we need to try and work that out currently.
Thank you very much, Dave.
You're welcome.
That was Dave Latham, a PhD candidate in the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta. The Sustainable Forest Management Network is a national research organization with partners from many sectors, including academia, industry, government, Aboriginal communities, and environmental organizations. One of these partners is Louisiana Pacific. Barry Waito is the company's area forest manager in Manitoba, where Louisiana Pacific operates an oriented strand board plant. Barry talked about his company's research partnership at the recent Sustainable Forest Management Network conference in Edmonton.
We're in west central Manitoba, it would be called. It would be an area borders against the Saskatchewan-Manitoba border, over to Lake Winnipegosis at the south end, Riding Mountain Park, and at the north end, about 50 miles north of Swan River.
Now, Louisiana Pacific has been a member of the Sustainable Forest Management Network for quite a long time, and you've been partnered to a lot of the scientific research that has been developed. How are you actually taking that and integrating it into the work that you do, your logging operations?
Well, we start the integration way back at the front end. We sit down with researchers and our staff and our stakeholders, and we identify what the issues or the problems are that we need to solve. And we build the research from the front end into that, including those people in the discussion. And so as the research gets done, the integration of that research becomes far easier. And so it's really a whole package deal. It's not just showing up and saying, well, let's do some research on this. It's actually got a plan behind it.
So has it been very easy or very challenging to make, I guess, the transition from dealing with the scientific aspects of it and actually turning into something that's useful? Like, you do have an end use in mind, but is it easy to make that transition?
Not always. We have the issue of you sometimes have researchers who don't have a lot of interest in implementing their research on the ground. At the same time, we have a receptor problem sometimes with our company staff or loggers, if you will, on implementing new things on the ground. And so it's a matter of trying to take the nervousness, if you will, from both of those sides, take the research, be able to bring it down to a more ground level. Sometimes you need to bring in somebody else to help you with that. Some researchers don't want to do that or aren't really built to deal with a ground level kind of discussion or result. And then taking that and making the integration of it through your own staff and contractors the same way, by not making it something to be frightened of. And I think the way that works is you include them in the whole discussion from the start. And so if they're part of understanding what it is you're trying to solve, they're much more likely to help you implement it once you come up with an answer.
Can you give me an example of some things that have made a real change for you in your operations?
Well, certainly. We had some research done on what we call slash loading, which is Manitoba, all the limbs and tops of trees, hardwood or softwood, are left on site. So when the tree is cut down at the stump, you do all of that work there and not at the side of the road. So what happens sometimes is you end up with too much slash. It's too deep. And we had a research project that was done through the network that went and assessed what happens when there's too much slash and how much is too much slash. And they actually put together a nice, 10-page user-friendly document that said, if it looks like this, it's bad. And the reason it's bad is because the trees we're using here are regenerating based on roots that are in the ground that need certain soil temperatures. And if you have this much slash on top of the ground, the soil won't warm up. You don't get regeneration. And so it was really an issue of getting regeneration success. And it's driven by how much slash you leave on the land base. And so our operators have those books. And they understand when they leave too much slash in an area that they need to go back and thin it out, spread it around, pick some of it up and move it somewhere else. And that's a very classic example of taking an issue that was a silviculture issue of not getting enough regeneration and working with researchers to find out why that is and then coming up with a solution that we can go back to the actual people on the ground and implement it. And it's working quite well.
One of the things that you focused on in the presentation today is a new computer modeling program called Patchworks. What is Patchworks and how has it helped you?
Well, I'm not the Patchworks expert, but Patchworks is a spatially explicit modeling tool that has an ability to handle almost an infinite number of controls, management controls or ways of dealing with a high end or a low end of a target you're trying to hit. And so what Patchworks can do is it can handle those simultaneously, numerous ones of them, and do it in a way that deals with the spatial impact on the land base. Because at the same time you need to do management controls, you also need to have a workable solution that you can conduct your operations on. And so it's been able to do that without a significant amount of, we used to do it with maps and maps that you would do by hand. Well, Patchworks can show you over time, 200-year wood forecast, what your changes are over every 5-year period. And so it's very, 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 very well suited to the kind of work we were doing.
Well, I found it quite interesting, the example you gave of how you used it with your stakeholder public advisory group and the difference that make. How did you actually use it?
Well, we explained to them what the model was. We brought the generators of the Patchworks model right in. You know, Tom Moore came to our location, sat down, explained what the model was. We showed them a very simplistic model. We let them come up with some ideas on some things they'd like us to try in the model. Then we actually put them in the model and tried it and said, okay, here's the result of what it was that you thought was important to put a management control on. So they could see very, firsthand that, very simple requests or complicated ones, if you will, even, can have a significant impact on the model, and they could then understand the give and take the model has to have. Because, it's a finite resource, if you will, and if you want to control on something, you got to relax something somewhere else because there has to be some elasticity in the system. And I think that's the best way we dealt with the stakeholders is to make it non-threatening to them and keep it as simple as we could.
How about public regulation on the part of the government and new policies?
Well, the policy adaptive management issue continues to confound us. It's companies are being required by publics and by governments to step up and do adaptive management, do the research so that we can change our practices, and we often find that in so doing that we run right into a brick wall of a policy that needs to be changed that the government right now isn't willing to change. And so you have to almost negotiate as to how you're going to implement what your research just did, or at least suggested you should do, with a government that isn't yet ready to change a policy. And so that's not solved yet, not in our area, not in anywhere. Probably across the country. I think we're working at it, but policy piece is a far slower piece to move than the practices are.
What do you think then of the Sustainable Forest Management Network in terms of helping you in your operations?
Well, I think the advantage of the network really is it has a group of people which includes industrial partners, Aboriginals, governments, NGOs, if you will, and universities, so that we can start getting at some of the rough areas, if you will, the ability to take research and change policy. And I think by having those groups of people around the table, we can have those frank discussions and start thinking about some solutions within the network structure, which doesn't exist too many other places to have this kind of a grouping. But we can start working at how do we, ease the rough edges, if you will, between moving from one paradigm, if you will, down to another. And I think that's what the benefit of their network really is. It brings people together that typically wouldn't talk across the country so that you get the ability to learn from what one part of the country has done and how you might apply it where you are.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Thank you.
That was Barry Wato, the Area Forest Manager for Louisiana Pacific and Swan River, Manitoba. He was a presenter at the recent Sustainable Forest Management Network conference in Edmonton. Louisiana Pacific isn't the only company using the computer modeling software called Patchworks. It's a program that forest planners in industry and government have picked up across the country. Patchworks has become an extremely useful tool that allows planners to look decades into the future to see what current logging or tree planting will do to the forests of our grandchildren. Patchworks was developed by Thomas Moore, president of Spatial Planning Systems in Deep River, Ontario.
Patchworks is a spatially explicit simulation modeling tool for forest planners, and it's a bit of a new type of program that's been enabled by faster computers and more expressive programming languages and better libraries for doing this kind of development. Couldn't have done this 10 years ago, but now it's becoming possible with better technology.
Now, your background is as a forester. How does a forester get into computer modeling?
Well, I guess I went against the grain a bit because most students choose to go into forestry because they hate math and the technical subjects and want to get out in the bush. But I had an aptitude for computer programming as an undergraduate, and one of my first job was with the Canadian Forest Service, taking a look at geographic information systems and compiling national inventory and doing a lot of work with computers and simulation models.
Now, one of the things in Patchworks, when you're dealing with forest issues, it's so complex. There's so many different layers of information that you have to put in and The other thing that I've learned about dealing with forestry issues is that if you do one thing, it might be good in this area, but not necessarily so great in another. How do you take all of that diversity and put it all together into a program that can actually help people?
Well, that's the challenge, and I guess it comes from a history of developing simulation models and learning some of the pitfalls along the way. So some of the first simulation models I worked with were very specific and special purpose and designed for only one forest type. And as I began developing simulation models, I was looking for ways to try to generalize and make them more broadly applicable. And Patchworks, as a third or fourth generation tool, we've tried to fully generalize it to make it as widely applicable as possible to different forest types, different silviculture, different planning problems.
Now, your presentation today, you were talking about how Patchworks was used by Louisiana Pacific. Can you give me an example of how they used it?
Patchworks was used as an integration tool to try to bring the research that they had done in many different areas to bear and give some insight into the impacts of some of their management programs. We were able to take research projects on hydrological function and biodiversity and the ecological land inventory and response to silviculture and the bird survey data and the synthesis of its results and try to bring it all into one package where we could examine the impact of different management strategies and how they would influence the outcome of a whole suite of indicators.
What's next for you in Patchworks program?
Well, there's always an R&D list that extends for 2 years, but there's as many emerging issues in forestry that as soon as we feel like we've been able to address one issue well, there's another issue emerging around the corner. So there's no end to the challenges in store.
Do you see applications of this for other industries?
Oh, certainly, but the field is just so large. The combinatorial optimization techniques that are used in Patchworks come from the field of circuit design and circuit layout, and they be equally applicable to other fields such as transportation, logistics planning as well.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
Thank you.
That was Thomas Moore, President of Spatial Planning Systems in Deep River, Ontario. He was a presenter at the recent Sustainable Forest Management Network Conference in Edmonton. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the NSERC Industrial Research Chair in Integrated Landscape Management, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, Genome Alberta, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.